reads $0. She drifts to the piece next to it. It's painted on a piece of recessed door panel stood on its side. The inset panel in turn becomes a door, which opens onto a clearing through a thick tangle of branches. She scans the table, covered in works with similar subjects. Always trees, snaking in through the windows, walls, or ceilings of seemingly safe rooms, seeking out some human target like heat-seeking probes. In some of the works, painted words float above the surreal scenes. Family tree, shoe tree, money tree, barking up the wrong tree. On another table, four sculptures of black clay wave like the hands of the dead rising out of the ground on the judgment day. Every one of the pieces bears a green tag reading $0. Okay. First of all, I'll give you two for the price of one, since you're my first customer. She sets down the drawing in her hands and looks at its maker. His arms cross his chest and grasp his shoulders, like he's putting himself in a straitjacket before the world does. Why are you doing this? He shrugs. Free seems to be what the market will bear. You should be selling these in New York, Chicago. Don't talk to me about Chicago. I drew anamorphic sidewalk chalk illusions down in Grant Park for 2.5 years. Got stepped on a lot. She purses her lips, listening for guidance. But having brought her here, free tree art, the beings of light abandon her. I'm the first person who has stopped? I know. Like, who wouldn't stop for a sign like that? The nearest town is 12 miles away, and that one has 50 people. I was thinking I'd get mainly fleeing felons. You're not a fleeing felon, by any chance? She must think, figure out how this fits into the mission she has just been given. She goes from one table to the next. Surreal Cornell boxes filled with intricate woody contraband. Assemblages of broken ceramic, beads, and slices of tire rubber made to look like roots and tendrils. The branches that led her here. You made all this? And they're all... My tree period. 9 years and a couple months. She studies his face for the key it must contain. Perhaps she has a key for him. But she doesn't even know what the lock might be. She steps toward him and he lurches back, sticking out his hand. She takes it and they trade names. Olivia Vandergriff holds Nick Hole's hand for a moment, feeling for an explanation. Then she lets it drop and turns back toward the art. Almost a decade? And everything is trees? For some reason, this makes him laugh. Another half century and I'll be my own grandfather. She looks at him, puzzled. By way of explanation, he leads her to a card table on the side of the exhibit. He passes her a thick, handmade book. She opens to the first page, a fanatically detailed pen and ink drawing of a young tree. The next page has the same drawing. Flip it, he mimes the suggestion with his own thumbs. She does. The thing spirals upward into life. Jesus, that's the tree out front. Another fact he doesn't deny. She flips again. The simulation runs too accurately to be the product of mere imagination. How did you make these? From photographs. One a month for 76 years. I come from a long and distinguished line of obsessive compulsives. She browses some more. He watches, edgy, eager, a small business owner on the brink of bankruptcy. If there's anything you like, I can pack it up for you. Is this your farm? My extended family's. They just sold it to the devil and all his subsidiaries. I have 2 months to vacate. How do you live? The man grins and tips his head. You're making a big assumption. You have no income? Life insurance policies. You sell them? No, I get paid by them. Until now. He looks at the tables of stock like a dubious auctioneer. I'm 35 years old. Not a whole lot to show for a life's work. The man's confusion radiates from him like heat from a log fire. She feels it from 2 yards away. Why? The word comes out wilder than she planned. Why the giveaway? I don't know. It felt like another artwork. The last of the series. Trees give it all away, don't they? The equation electrifies her. Art and acorns. Both profligate handouts that go mostly wrong. The man casts a cold eye over the sawhorses and planks. You could call it a fire sale. No, a fungus sale. What does that mean? Here. He moves toward the barn door. I'll show you. They cut across the snow-crusted field, past the house. She stops to grab her parka. He has nothing but jeans and the waffle shirt. Aren't you cold? Always. Cold is good for you. People keep themselves way too warm. Nick leads her across the property, and there the mammoth thing stands, spread out against the porcelain sky. Strange and beautiful math governs the subtending of the 100 branches, 1,000 twigs, 10,000 twiglets, a beauty that the barnful of art has just primed her to see. I've never seen a tree anything like that. Few living people have. From the interstate, she failed to notice the thing's thick, tapering grace, the way it flows upward to the first generous cleave. She wouldn't have noticed except for the flip book. What is it? Chestnut. The redwoods of the east. The word puckers her flesh all over. Confirmation, though she hardly needs it. They pass through the drip line and under the crown. All gone now. Why, you've never seen one. He tells her how his great-great-great-grandfather planted the tree, how his great-great-grandfather started photographing at the century's start, how blight crossed the map in a few years and wiped out the best tree in Eastern America, how this rogue and loner specimen, so far from any contaminant, survived. She looks up into the net of branches. Each limb is a study for another of those stricken sculptures back in the barn. Something happened to this man's family. She sees that as if reading it off a crib sheet. And he has been living in this ancestor-built house for a decade, making art from a freak Titan survivor. She puts her hand on the fissured bark. And you've outgrown it? Moving on? He recoils, horrified. No. Never. It's done with me. He circles to the other side of the gigantic bowl. The long Renaissance finger points again. Dry rings with orange spots spread from several places across the bark. He presses the spots. They cave in at his touch. She touches the spongy trunk. Oh, shit. What is this? Death, unfortunately. They back away from the dying god. With slow steps, they make their way up the rise toward the house. He kicks his shoes against the back door stoop to clear the snow from them. He waves toward the barn, his would-be gallery. Would you please take a piece or two with you? That would make today a very good day. First, I have to tell you why I'm here. He makes tea on the stove in the kitchen where his parents and grandmother sat on that morning a decade ago when he said goodbye to them and drove to the art museum in Omaha. His visitor tells her story through grimaces and smiles. She describes the night of her transformation, the hash, the damp nakedness, the fatal lamp socket. He sits and listens, blushing and hanging on her every description. I don't feel crazy. That's the weird thing. I was crazy before. I know what crazy feels like. This all feels, I don't know, like I'm finally seeing the obvious. She cups her hands over the hot teacup. The dead chestnut agitates her in a way he doesn't fully get. She's young, free, impulsive, and full of a new cause. By every reliable measure, she's more than a little tilted. But he wants her to stay like this, talking crazy theories in his kitchen all night. There's company in the house. Someone has come back from the dead.
You don't sound crazy, he fibs.
Not crazy dangerous, anyway. Believe me, I know what I sound like. Resurrection, bizarre coincidences, messages from television sets and a discount warehouse store, beings of light I can't see.
Well, when you put it that way.
But there's an explanation. There must be. Maybe it's all my subconscious, finally paying attention to something other than me. Maybe I heard about these tree protesters weeks ago, before I electrocuted myself, and now I'm finally seeing them everywhere.
He knows what it means to take dictation from ghosts. He has been alone for so long, sketching his own dying tree, that he wouldn't dare gainsay anyone's theories. No strangeness stranger than the strangeness of living things. He chuckles, chewing on the bitter nib. I've made magical trinkets for the last 9 years. Secret signals are my idiom.
That's what I don't get. Her eyes beg him for mercy. Her tea, the steam on her face, the wilds of snowy Iowa, a story so old and large she can't wrap her head around it. I'm driving down the road and see your sign hanging from a tree that looks like...
Well, you know, if you drive far enough...
I don't know. I don't know what to believe. It's stupid to believe anything at all. We're always, always wrong. He sees himself painting that face in bright war paint. Call it whatever you want. Something's trying to get my attention.
Someone thinks all his studies of the whole chestnut over the last decade might mean something. That's enough for him. He shrugs. It's amazing how crazy things become once you start looking at them. She goes from distress to conviction in 0 seconds.
That's what I'm saying. What's crazier, believing there might be nearby presences we don't know about, or cutting down the last few ancient redwoods on Earth for decking and shingles?
He lifts a finger and excuses himself upstairs. He comes back down carrying an old road atlas and 3 volumes from a shelf of encyclopedias his grandfather bought from a traveling salesman back in 1965. There is indeed a Solis California in the heart of the tall trees. There are, in fact, redwoods 30 stories tall and as old as Jesus. Crazy is a species under no threat at all. He looks at her. Her face glows with purpose. He wants to follow wherever her vision leads, and when that vision fails, he wants to follow wherever she goes next.
Aren't you hungry? She asks.
Always. Hunger's good for you. People should stay hungry. He makes her oatmeal with melted cheese and hot peppers. He tells her, "I'll need to think about it overnight."
"You're like me."
"How so?"
"I hear myself best when I'm sleeping."
He puts her in his grandparents' room, which he hasn't entered since Christmas 1980, except to dust. He sleeps down below, in his childhood cubby under the stairs. And all night long, he listens. His thoughts stretch in every direction, seeking the light. It comes to his attention that nothing else in his life can even generously be called a plan. When he wakes, she's in the kitchen, wearing a change of clothes from her car, scrounging up pancakes from flour he has let get infested by weevils. He sits at the center post table in his flannel robe. His voice catches on the words, "I need to clear out this house by the end of the month." She nods at the pancakes. "This can be done. And I need to dispose of my art. Beyond that, I have a little window on my calendar for the rest of the year." He looks out the many-paned kitchen window. Through the whole chestnut, the sky is so stupid with blue that it looks like it was slathered on by a primary schooler with finger paints. Spring comes again for Mimi Ma, the first without her father. The crabs, pears, redbuds, and dogwoods explode in pink and white. Every heartless petal mocks her. The mulberries, especially, make her want to set fire to everything that blooms. The man will never see a single part of this dazzlement, and still they overflow, the cruel, indifferent colors of now. Another spring follows hard on that one. Then a third. Work toughens her, or the flowers start to dull. Mimi's frequent flyer account turns platinum by May. They send her to Korea. They send her to Brazil. She learns Portuguese. She learns that people of all races, colors, and creeds have unlimited hunger for custom ceramic molding. She takes up running, hiking, and cycling. She takes up ballroom dancing, then jazz, then salsa, which banishes all other dance for her forever. She takes up birdwatching, and soon has a life list 130 species long. The company promotes her to section leader. She takes a course in Renaissance art, night courses in modern poetry, all the Holyoke stuff she tossed to become an engineer. The goal is almost patriotic. Play in every playground. Have it all. Be everything. A colleague talks her into playing hockey in the office league. Soon she can't get enough. She plays poker with men on four continents and sleeps with men on two. She spends a week in San Diego with a girl of astonishingly varied appetites whose heart she breaks despite their upfront agreement. She falls pretty much in love with a married guy on another hockey team who is ever so gentle when checking her into the boards. They meet once in Helsinki in December for a magic 3-day alternate life in the noonday dark. She never sees him again. She almost gets married. Immediately afterward, she can't remember how it ever came so close to happening. She turns 30. Then, dependable engineer, 31, and 32. In her sleep, she's forever passing through epic airports, in the middle of teeming crowds, when her name is paged. The company moves her into HQ. The $9,000 raise does almost nothing for her, but make her hungry right away again. But she graduates from a cubicle in a production facility to a corner office with a floor-length window looking out on a stand of pines that in her head somehow becomes the destination at the end of a very long family car trip. The world's smallest, most private wilderness stand-in. She decorates the office with things her mother doesn't know she's stolen. A suitcase covered in pennants. Carnegie Institute. General Meigs. University of Nanking. A steamer trunk stenciled with an unpronounceable name. Framed on her desk is a photo of two people, reportedly her grandparents, holding a photo of their three inexplicable grandchildren. Next to that, there's a print of that same photo within a photo, three little racially ambiguous girls sitting primly on a couch, pretending they're Wheaton's own. The oldest seems ready to bully her way into belonging, ready to punch out anyone who thinks she's lost. Around the walls of the office, like a classical frieze, runs her father's scroll. It's wrong to expose the paintings even to the tiny amounts of northwest sun that trickle through her floor-to-ceiling window. Wrong to apply an adhesive to the backing of art so old and rare. Wrong to leave something priceless where anyone on the night crew might roll it up and pop it into an overall pocket. Wrong to hang the thing where it reminds her of her father's suicide every time she lifts her eyes. People who step into her office for the first time often ask about the junior Buddhas in the foyer of enlightenment. She hears her father on the day he showed her the scroll for the first time. These men, they pass the final exam. There are days at her desk, in her furious professional success, looking up at the scroll from the rising tide of invoices and estimates, when she sees herself getting the same final grade her father did. When the drowning feel tightens up under her breasts, she looks out through the floor-length window onto her grove, where three briefly free and wild girls collect pinecone currencies on the shores of an ancient lake. Sometimes it almost calms her. Sometimes she can almost see the man, squatting on his haunches and writing everything there is to say about this campground into his copious notebook. Her colleagues use her office as a lunchroom, during lunches when she isn't eating thousand-year eggs. Today her menu is chicken sandwich, so the place is safe for all ethnicities. Three other managers and a punk from HR pile in for penny ante up and down the river. Mimi's in. She's always in for any game involving pointless risk and temporary oblivion. Her only stipulation is that she gets the commander's chair. "What exactly does it command, Captain?" She waves toward the window. "This view." The other players look up from their cards. They squint and shrug. Okay, a small parkway across the shallow lot filled with trees. Trees are what the Northwest does. Trees everywhere, at every elevation, crowding each other out, creeping in, closing out the sky. Pines, the VP of marketing guesses. A QC manager who wants Mimi's job declares, ponderosas. "Willamette Valley ponderosa pine," says Britannica Man, director of R&D. Cards float across the office table. Penny piles change hands. Mimi fingers her jade ring. She wears it carving inward, so no one's tempted to hack off her finger to steal it. She gives the ring a twist. The gnarled mulberry of Fusang, the tree she drew when the sisters divvied up her father's possessions, spins around her finger. Her palm cups toward the dealer, all business. "Come on, give me something to work with here." Another bust hand. She raises her eyes again. Blue noon pours through her private woodland. The sun cuts starbursts in the needle's verdigris, a thousand sconces of astral light. The great dinosaur plates of the trunks turn shades of orange, terracotta, and cinnamon. The QC man, who wants her job, says, "You ever smell the bark?" "Vanilla," the QC guy says. "That's the Jeffrey pine," announces Britannica Man. Look who's an expert. Again.
Not vanilla, turpentine. I'm telling you, says the QC guy, ponderosa pine, vanilla. I took a course.
Britannica man shakes his head. Nope. Turpentine.
Somebody go sniff the cracks, snickers all around.
The QC guy smacks the table. Cards skim and pennies fall.
$10.
Now we're talking, says the punk from HR.
Mimi's halfway to the door before anyone knows what's happening.
Hey, we've got a game going here.
Data,
the engineer's engineer daughter answers. And in a few steps, she's outside. The smell is on her before she reaches the trees, the scent of resin and wide western places, the clean smell of her childhood's only untouched days. The music of the trees, too, tuning the wind. She remembers. Her nose slips into one of those dark fissures between the flat terracotta plates. She falls into the smell, a devastating whiff of 200 million years ago. She can't imagine what such perfume was ever meant to do, but it does something to her now. Mind control. It's neither vanilla nor turpentine, but replete with highlights of each. A shot of spiritual butterscotch. A sprig of pineapple incense. It smells like nothing but itself. Pungent and sublime. She breathes in, eyes closed, the tree's real name. She stands with her nose in the bark, perversely intimate. She doses herself for a long time, like a hospice patient self-administering the morphine. Chemicals rush down her windpipe, through the bloodstream to her body's provinces, across the blood-brain barrier and into her thoughts. The smell grips her brainstem until she and the dead man are fishing side by side again under the pine shade where the fish hide in the soul's innermost national park. A woman passing by on the sidewalk sees her sniffing and wonders whether there might be an emergency. Blissed by memory and volatile organics, Mimi calms her with a look. Back in the office, her card-playing companions stand at her floor-length window, watching her like she's turned dangerous. She leans back into the tree, falling one last time into that unnameable scent. Eyes shut, she summons up the arhat under his pine, that slight amusement on his lips as he tips over the brink into full-fledged acceptance of life and death. Something comes over her. The light grows brighter. The smell deepens. Detachment floats her upward, buoyed by the tides of her childhood. She turns from the trunk with a profound sense of well-being. Is this it? Am I there? Taped to the trunk of the next tree over is a handmade sign. Town Hall Meeting, May 23rd. She drifts toward the poster and reads. The city has declared the accumulation of dead needles and bark to be a fire hazard, and the trees too old and expensive to clean up year after year. They plan to replace the pines with a cleaner, safer species. Forces opposed to the removal have asked for a public hearing. Come, make your feelings known. They want to cut her trees. She looks back across the way to the office. Her colleagues press to the glass, laughing at her. They wave their hands. They rap on the window. One of them takes her picture with a disposable camera. Her nose fills with a sachet beyond the crudity of words. Call it remembering. Call it prediction. Vanilla, pineapple, butterscotch, turpentine. A man just shy of 40 hands out silver dollars in the Spar Roadhouse, off Route 212, not far from a town aptly named Damascus, Oregon.
Celebration, damn it! You have to spend it on a beer.
The request has its takers.
The hell we celebrating, Rockefeller? My 50,000th tree. 9 hours a day, rain or shine, 5.5 days a week, through every planting month for almost 4 years.
Scattered applause and one owl hoot. Everybody in the place says he'll drink to that.
Tough work for an old guy. You replace your lumbar region yet? You know, they're just gonna cut them right back down again couple more years.
Gratitude of roadhouse strangers bought a drink for nothing. Douglas Pavlicek smiles and abides. He stacks 20 more silver dollars on the corner of a pool table and waves his stick with the hard rock maple shaft in the air, inviting all comers. Soon he has two takers, Dumb and Dee. They play three ball in rotation. Douglas is beyond pitiful. 4 years of scrambling across slash, slag, and mud, stooping and planting, has shot his nervous system, wrecked his bum leg, and left him with a motor tremor that shows up on seismometers down in the Bay Area. Dumb and Dee feel almost bad taking his money, rack after rack, inning after inning, pot after pot. But Dougie has a time of it, here in the big city, knocking back foamy dog piss and remembering the joy of anonymous company. He'll sleep in a bed tonight, take a hot shower. 50,000 trees. Dumb sinks all three balls on the break. His second on the snap tonight. Maybe he's racking them for an instant win. Douglas Pavlicek doesn't care. Then D completes in four.
So, 50,000 trees, Dumb says, just to distract Dougie, who's struggling enough without the cognitive load of having to carry on a conversation. Yep. Could die now, and I'd be ahead of the game. What do you do for women out there? Plenty of women tree slingers. Summer vacation for a lot of them. Anything goes.
Distracted by happy memories, he pockets the cue ball. Even that's worth a laugh.
Who are you planting for?
Whoever pays me.
Lot of new oxygen out there because of you. Lot of greenhouse gases put to bed.
People have no idea.
You know they make shampoo with wood, shatterproof glass, toothpaste. I did not know that. Shoe polish, ice cream thickener. Buildings, am I right? Books and such, boats. Furniture?
People have no idea.
Still the age of wood. Cheapest, priceless stuff that ever has been. Amen, buddy. $20 on another round?
They play for hours. Dougie, who can drink without apparent consequence, battles back from the brink. Dee and Dumb cycle out, replaced by newcomers, Things 1 and 2. Doug buys another round, explaining for the graveyard shift just what they're celebrating.
50,000 trees.
Huh.
It's a start, Douglas says.
Thing 2 is in strong contention for asshole of the night. Weak, even.
Hate to burst your bubble, friend, but you know that BC alone takes out 2 million log trucks a year? By itself. You'd have to plant for like 4 or 5 centuries just to... Okay, let's keep shooting here.
And those companies you plant for? You realize they get good citizen credits for every seedling you plant? Every time you stick one in the ground, it lets them raise the annual allowable cut.
No, Douglas says. That can't be right.
Oh, it's right, all right. You're putting in babies so they can kill grandfathers. And when your seedlings grow out, they'll be monocrop blights, man. Drive-through diners for happy insect pests.
Okay. Shut the fuck up for a second, please.
Douglas holds up his cue, then his head.
You win, friend. Party's over.
Mimi drops out of the next noon's card game, eats her lunch al fresco under the pines.
Can we use your office anyway? The HR punk asks.
All yours. Knock yourself out.
She sits, her back to the orange trunks, looks up into the flares of light cutting through the sheaths of needles,
imitates the Arhat, waits, breathes. This is how it was with the Indian prince Siddhartha when life abandoned him and his pleasures went away. He sat under a magnificent peepal, a bow, ficus religiosa, and vowed not to stand up again until he understood what life wanted from him. 1 month passed, then another. Then he woke up from the dream of humankind. Truths blazed into his head. Things so simple, hidden in broad light. At that moment, the tree above the new Buddha, cuttings from which still grow across the globe, burst into flowers, and the flowers changed into plump purple figs. Mimi waits for nothing even a hundredth so grandiose. In fact, she waits for nothing at all. For enough nothing to lose herself in. That unnameable scent. That's all she wants. This grove. That 200-million-year-old scent. Her family at its freest best, their own native nation. Fishing again, at the side of the only man who ever knew her, in the current of a river that isn't long gone. A woman with a double-wide stroller packed with twins sits for a moment on a nearby bench.
Nice spot of shade, Mimi says. Did you know the city wants to cut these down?
Getting political. Agitating. She hates agitators, how they're always in your face about something that has nothing to do with you. In another minute, she's telling the frightened young mom about the town hall meeting on the 23rd, and the ghost of her father stands not far away, under his pines, smiling at her. Douglas Pavlicek wakes as Mimi fills her lungs one last time and returns to climate control. He takes another brief forever to realize he's in his motel room, the one he rented after giving away $200 in beers and losing another $100 at three ball. None of that even makes him wince. This afternoon, the waking dread is more substantial. All his anxiety is trained on the annual allowable cut, and whether for the last 4 years he's been suckered into wasting his life, or worse. He's missed the complimentary continental breakfast by 4 hours. But the clerk sells him an orange, a chocolate bar, and a cup of coffee. 3 priceless tree treasures that get him to the public library. There he finds a librarian to help him research. The man pulls several volumes of policy and code off the shelf, and together they search. The answer isn't good. Thing, too, that loud bastard, was right. Planting seedlings has done nothing but greenlight more colossal clear cuts. It's dinner time when Dougie accepts this fact beyond all doubt. He has eaten nothing all day since his 3 tree gifts, but the idea of eating again, ever, nauseates him. He needs to walk. Walking. The only sane thing left. What he really wants is to rush out to a scalped hillside and get the future back into the ground. It's what his muscles know, especially that largest muscle in his inventory, his soul. A shovel and a shoulder bag full of green recruits. What he, until today, thought of as hope. He walks all evening, stopping only to compromise with his body. A burger, which skips his taste buds on the way down. The night is soft and the air so light that for half a mile he forgets his freefall dread. But he can't stop the questions. What do I do now for the next 40 years? What work can't the efficiency of unified mankind chop into pure fertilizer? He walks for hours and miles, skirting downtown Portland into a peaceful mixed-use neighborhood, drawn along by a scent he can't name. He stops into a corner grocery to get a bottle of greenish juice, which he drinks while reading notices on a bulletin board by the store's exit. Highly intelligent missing cat. Chi rebalancing. Cheap long-distance calling. And then, town hall meeting, May 23rd. Some lunatic legacy inside his species' brains does not work and play well with others. He asks the kid at the cash register where the park in question is. Kid looks like a rat bit his nose.
That's too far to walk.
Try me. Turns out Dougie passed it on the way here. He doubles back along the route he came. He smells the little pocket park before he sees it, like a slice of God's birthday cake. The condemned trees all have three needles to a bundle, large orange plates. Old friends. He sets up base camp on a bench under the pines. He lets the trees comfort him. It's dark, but the neighborhood seems safe. Safer than flying transports over Cambodia. Safer than a lot of bars he's fallen asleep in. He'd like to fall asleep here. Fuck practicality and all its binding obligations. Give a guy a night outdoors, with nothing between his bare head and a seed rain. The 23rd, it occurs to him, town meeting, is only 4 days away. His dream, when it comes, is more vivid than it has been for years. This time, the plane goes down in the Khmer jungle. Captain Straub is impaled on some malignant undergrowth Douglas can't see. Levine and Bragg land nearby, but Douglas can't reach them, and in a while they stop answering his shouts. He's alone again, in what he realizes is a bizarro Portland, swallowed entirely by a single banyan. He wakes to the sound of helicopters scouring the canopy, shining floodlights, and looking for him. Tonight the helicopters turn into trucks. Men pile out of them, with gear. For a minute there's still grunts coming to immolate Dougie's village in a final firefight. Then he wakes up enough to see chainsaws. He checks his watch. A little after midnight. At first he thinks he has fallen asleep for 4 days. He gets himself vertical and heads out on recon.
Hey!
He draws near the gear drop.
Hello?
The hard hats recoil as from a crazy person.
You're not setting up, are you?
They keep working, gassing up the hardware, running a tape corral around the perimeter, positioning the Saurian cherry picker into place and locking down its braces.
You've made a mistake or something. The hearing's in a few days. Read the poster.
Some kind of crew head comes up to him. Not threatening exactly. The word is authorized.
Sir, we're going to have to ask you to leave before we start cutting. You're cutting? It's pitch dark.
But of course it isn't. Not with twin banks of arc lights wheeled into place. There is no more pitch dark. Then the civic-sized penny drops.
Hang on a sec. City orders, the foreman says. You're going to have to move to the other side of the tape.
City orders?
What the hell does that even mean?
It means move out, beyond the tape. Douglas breaks toward the doomed trees. The move stuns everyone. It takes a second before the hardhats give chase. He's a few feet up one of the trunks before they reach him. They grab his feet. Somebody knocks him with the butt of a long pruning shaft. He smacks to the ground and lands on his bum leg.
Don't do this! This is fucked up!
Two cutters pin him on the ground until the police show. It's 1 in the morning. Just another crime against public property, executed while the city sleeps. This time the charges against him are public nuisance, obstructing official business, and resisting arrest.
You think this is funny? Demands the officer who handcuffs him. Believe me, you would too.
At the station on 2nd Street, they ask his name.
Prisoner 571.
It takes removing his wallet from his jeans by force to get his real ID. And they need to isolate him, to keep him from rabble-rousing the other criminals into an uprising. 7:30 a.m. Mimi hits the office early. An Argentinian order of impellers for centrifugal pumps has gone awry. She sets down her coffee, flips on the overhead lights, powers up her machine, and waits to boot into the corporate LAN. She swivels for a glance outside and howls. Where there should be foliage, there's only an expanse of gray-blue cumulonimbus. In 2 minutes, she's standing on the bald patch, the trees she used to look out on for a moment's remembering and peace. She hasn't even changed out of her trainers into her slingbacks. The prim clearing denies that anything ever happened. Not a trunk or a branch left behind. Only sawdust and shed needles around the fresh, flat cuts flush with the ground. Yellow-orange wood exposed to the air, sap rising on the outmost edges of the rings. Rings beyond rings, many more rings than she has years. And the scent of it. The smell of anticipation and loss, of fresh-cut pine. The message, the drug that worked her brain, concentrated now, laid open in death. It starts to drizzle. She closes her eyes. Outrage floods into her, the sneakiness of man, a sense of injustice larger than her whole life, the old loss that will never, ever be answered. When her eyes open again, truths rush into her head, like enlightenment, but without the glow. Germination happens fast. Nile finishes his space opera. Some part of the elongated boy in the futuristic wheelchair still wants to give the game away for free. But there comes a moment, as there always does in the game itself, when you must turn your pretty backwater sector of the universe into a revenue stream. Publishing the game requires a company, if only a fake one. Corporate HQ is his ground floor efficiency with access ramp near El Camino in Redwood City. The business needs a name, even if the entire outfit is nothing but a crippled 20-something Indian-American rolling around like a bundle of twigs in a dog cart. But naming a company turns out to be harder than coding up a planet. For 3 days, Nile plays with portmanteaus and neologisms, all of which come up short or have already been taken. He's sucking on his dinner, a cinnamon toothpick, and staring at some faked-up letterhead when the word Redwood pops out of his return address. It's like someone whispers the obvious answer into his ear. Using a paint program, he mocks up a logo, a ripoff of Stanford's fearsome tree, and Semper Virens is born. He calls the company's first release The Sylvan Prophecies. With state-of-the-art DTP software, he designs an ad. At the top of the page, he centers the words, "There's a whole new planet right next door." Then Nile runs the ad in the back of comics and computer magazines across the country. A disc dupe outfit over in Menlo Park pumps out 3,000 floppies. He hires 2 ex-Stanford friends to get the game into stores up and down both coasts. Within a month, The Sylvan Prophecies sells out. Nile dupes more discs. They sell out again. He's stunned that so many rigs out there meet the game's minimum specs. Word of mouth keeps spreading. Revenues flow in, and soon there's too much work for him to handle alone. He signs a 5-year lease on a former dentist's suite. He hires a secretary and calls her the office manager. He hires a hacker and calls him the lead programmer. He signs a guy with an accounting degree who metamorphoses into a business manager. Assembling the team feels like building up the home planet in the Sylvan Prophecies. From scores of applicants, he hires the ones who flinch the least when they see his stick-figure body sprouting from the motorized chair. Astonishingly, the new employees prefer cash up front to shares in the future. It's a total failure of imagination. They haven't a clue where their species is headed. He tries to talk them around, but they all elect for safety and cash. Soon, the business manager breaks it to Nile. It's not enough to pretend he's a company. He has to incorporate for real. Semper Virens becomes a legal person. Nile goes to bed at night, dreaming of branching and spreading. It's a brand new industry with an unlimited growth curve. He needs only a few market hits, each one compounding the success of the previous. Then he'll make the world over, the way it was shown to him in a flash by alien life forms in the wild terrarium of Stanford's inner court. By day, when he isn't learning how to run a company, Nile keeps on coding. Programming still amazes him. Declare a variable. Specify a procedure. Call each well-formed routine to do its part inside larger, cleverer, more capable structures, like organelles building up a cell. And up from simple instructions emerges an entity with autonomous behavior. Words into action. It's the planet's next new thing. Coding, he's still a boy of 7, with the whole world of living possibilities coming up the stairs in his father's arms. The first game is still selling at a healthy clip, when Semper Virens releases the sequel. The new Sylvan Prophecies employs unbelievable verisimilitude in an astonishing 256 colors. There's real packaging now, with professional artwork, though the gameplay is the same old exploration and trading set in a glorious new higher-res galaxy. The public doesn't care that it's a rehash. The public can't get enough. They love the world's open-ended nature. There's no real way to win the game. As with running a business, the point is to keep playing for as long as possible. The new Sylvan Prophecies tops the charts, even before its ancestor falls out of the top 10. Players post messages in online bulletin boards about wild creatures they find on backwater planets, odd, unpredictable combinations of animal, vegetable, and mineral. Lots of people find baiting the game's flora and fauna more entertaining than finding the treasure at the galaxy's core. Together, the two games make more money than many Hollywood movies, on a much lower outlay. Nile plows all profits back into the third installment, already more ambitious than the previous two games combined. When The Sylvan Revelation appears 9 months later, it lists for an outrageous $50. But for growing numbers of people, that's a small price to pay for a transformative experience that didn't even exist 2 years ago. A big publisher called Digit Arts offers to purchase the brand. The arrangement makes all kinds of sense. Professionals would take over sales and distribution of all future products, freeing Semper Virens to devote itself to development. Nile doesn't want to run a company. He wants to make worlds. The Digit Arts offer would guarantee his freedom and keep him in state-of-the-art wheelchairs forever. The night he agrees, in principle, to the deal, Nile can't sleep. He lies in his adjustable bed, trimmed by his mother's runner of quilted storage pockets and arched over by a steel grab bar wrapped in foam padding. Around midnight, his legs start spasming like an ambulatory person's. He needs to get up. That would be easier with the caregiver, but Gina doesn't come for another several hours. A button press brings the bed's head all the way upright. He wraps his arm around the right-hand vertical post and flings his left up in front of the horizontal bar. Muscle wastage has left his forearms looking like pared pieces of driftwood. His elbows flare out in swollen knots. It takes all his strength to lever himself into a seated position. His shoulders shake, and he squeezes past that moment when he always threatens to flop back onto the bed. He rocks for a while, to tilt his torso forward enough to fling both arms behind him and buttress himself upright. Step one. Of 52 or so, depending on how you count. His sweatpants are down around his knees in the ready position, where he keeps them when the calf is in. He leans as far as he can, bends almost double, so that the weight of his head and shoulders stays put long enough for him to plant his hands forward near his butt. His right arm slips under his left thigh. There's precious little meat left there as well. None, really. But it testifies to the baggage of his legs that they're still anchor enough to brace against and keep his shriveled torso upright. He grapples up the sweats and falls back onto his left elbow. Up swings the limp drawbridge of the leg. His butt lifts enough for him to fumble the seat of the pants over himself. Success is a while in coming. The leg drops, he falls back on his protruding shoulder blades, and he's prostrate all over again. Craning himself up once more with the bar-hung stirrup, he repeats the process on his right, until the sweats are drawn tightly squarely over his waist. Smoothing out the leggings on both sides takes time, but time in the middle of the night is an ample resource. Then a grab of the overhead bar, and, stabilized again, reaching out to one of the many hanging hooks filled with gear, he snags the U-shaped canvas sling, and, in 100 small increments, spreads it out on the bed around his body's upright stem. Each leg gets wrapped underneath in a strap pulled up through the middle. He stabs out again and spears the head of the winch, drags it across its own horizontal brace beam until it's positioned directly above. All four sling loops go over the winch's latches, two per side. He pops the remote in his mouth, and holding the straps in place, bites down on the power button until the winch lifts him upright. He affixes the remote to the sling and attaches the catheter's urine sac from the side of the bed. Holding the hose in his teeth to free both hands, he attaches the bag to the satchel he has wrapped himself in. Then he presses the winch button again, holds on, and goes airborne. There's always that moment as he scooches sideways through the air from bed to waiting chair when the whole precarious system wavers. He has shifted wrong before and come down hard, smacking metal struts and crashing to the floor in pain and urine. Tonight's ride, though, is error-free. The seat of the wheelchair must be adjusted, the wheels repositioned, but he sticks the landing. There, in the chair, he reverses all the steps, detaches the winch, hangs the bag, and, like Houdini, slips free of the sling underneath him without ever lifting. Donning the cassock is easy. The shoes, though slip-on and big as a clown's, are less so. But he's mobile now, zipping about by joystick and throttle, as easily as doing Immelmanns in a flight simulator. The whole ordeal has taken only a little over 30 minutes. Another 10, and he's out by the van, waiting for the hydraulic floor of the lift to lower to the ground. He rolls his chair onto the steel square and rides it up. He rolls through the open hull into the emptied-out cabin. The lift retracts. The doors slide shut, and he positions his chair in front of a console where pedal and brake are levers at waist level that even wasted arms can operate. Several dozen more commands in this algorithm of liberty, and he parks the van, exits, and rolls into the Stanford inner quad. He spins 360, surveying, surrounded again by those otherworldly life forms the way he was 6 years earlier. All those creatures from another galaxy far, far away. Dove tree, jacaranda, desert spoon, camphor flame, empress, Kurajong, red mulberry. He remembers how they whispered to him about a game he was destined to make, a game played by countless people worldwide, a game that puts the players smack in the middle of a living, breathing jungle filled with potential only dimly imaginable. Tonight, the trees are